Hello there, this is Richard Arlen Blake coming back to you with the 14th episode of my podcast Balladish Anish, Folklore Now. So the last few episodes I have been going over the folklore of specific states to sort of give you a regional variation, a regional insight into folklore and how each region has a lot of its own unique aspects, as well as a lot of things that it shares with other areas. You will find that there are a lot of stories and a lot of kinds of music or traditions that are similar, but they are definitely distinct to that particular region. With the advent of more traveling and people moving from place to place, of course, a lot of things do cross boundaries. That is one of the things that we discussed when we were talking about folk music way back when I was discussing several projects that I was doing as it related to folk music. So, having already done Rhode Island and Delaware, the two smallest states in the country, I now want to go to the state of Maryland. So, the state of Maryland I chose because it has several things in it, several aspects to it, that are not only unique, but have personal references to me as well recently, because I have actually recently been to the state of Maryland, to Baltimore, and have actually gone and interacted with a lot of people there and seen a lot of things that are of historical and cultural significance. With these particular things here in Maryland, you'll find that there are a lot of diverse changes that happen when you just get from one area of Maryland to another, which was similar to how it was, of course, decades ago before there was huge migration and traveling between the states. And my main visit in Maryland was in the city of Baltimore. And that was because the American Folklore Society was having its annual meeting there. And it just so happened that there are also two lighthouses right there in Baltimore. And so my lighthouse project, I was able to go and get two stamps for my lighthouse passport book. The funny thing about that is one of the places you go to get the stamp is a ship called the Constellation, the USS Constellation. When I told a lot of people that, I was going and I was seeing the USS Constellation that was in Baltimore Harbor, a lot of people of my connections online actually kept asking me, don't you mean the USS Constitution? And then, of course, you say, well, no, the USS Constitution is actually in Boston Harbor. It is not in Baltimore. It is the Constellation that is in Baltimore. And boat itself has a lot of history that can date back to the time of the Civil War as well. Having gone through many events in history, that ship actually does have a really interesting past to it, including a few things concerning ghosts. I will get back to that at another time, because here at this point, what I want to do is I have already, the last couple states I've been talking about what the state emblems are, like the state birds and the flowers and so forth. Since I had done that for both Rhode Island and for Delaware, I felt that it was imperative on me to do the same thing with Maryland. Now, in Maryland's case, the state bird is the Baltimore Oriole, which I think you might all consider certainly appropriate considering the baseball team by that name, the Baltimore Orioles. And the state tree is the white oak. The flower is the black-eyed Susan. I have not yet found out who Susan is and why she has her name on the state flower, but you know, that's kind of one of those things that you can look up for yourself, because, you know, like I said, this isn't quite folkloric enough for me to go too much into there, but I do think that understanding the fact that every state has these sort of things that they choose is a cultural thing that is sort of government regulated, but that people embrace when it comes along. And of course, the state animal is the blue crab. Interestingly enough, I have talked about the blue crab before as it relates to Delaware and about how people go and they fish for blue crab around that area. And since Delaware and Maryland are like right next to each other, it makes perfect sense that that particular animal would happen to be found in both places. It's just that in this case, it is the state animal. Then, of course, there is one of my favorite things that it so happens is the state song or the state anthem. Maryland's state anthem is called Maryland, My Maryland. It is actually a song that it was written back in 1861 by James Ryder Randall. What's interesting about this is while the Song of Delaware talked about each of the three counties that make up Delaware individually, and then they have a final verse that they sort of tacked on at the end many, many years later to solidify it. In Maryland, this song, Maryland, My Maryland, actually is almost like a history, telling of history of Maryland and about a lot of things that happened there. The song itself is said to be a call upon the people of the South to rise up against the U.S. forces to drive out those imperialists or, you know, whatever you call the unionists who are trying to take over and destroy the culture of Maryland. With Maryland, then, some people argue that Baltimore actually is the place where the Civil War began. You know, it wasn't the Battle of Bull Run, but was in fact an offshoot of what happened when the Massachusetts militia was traveling down through the state of Maryland in order to get to Washington, D.C. They needed to bring President Lincoln, the newly elected President Lincoln, to Washington, D.C., and of course, Maryland was kind of in the way. A lot of people who were sympathetic to the Confederacy rioted there in Baltimore and attacked the Massachusetts militia. There was fighting that went on across the city. And there in the Camden Street train station, a huge riot and fighting had finally been suppressed by the Massachusetts militia. And this song was pretty much generated there, and it spread out through the Confederacy. And interestingly enough, it became a kind of anthem of its own to support and inspire the Confederate states to rise up and continue fighting. And what's even more interesting is that the state of Maryland itself never seceded from the Union, but actually remained as part of the Union during the Civil War, despite what the sympathies of many of those people in Maryland had. Part of the reason why Maryland didn't secede as well was because the American troops were in there and helped to quell those kinds of things and keep any kind of uprising from happening. And you can understand why they were out eager to quench any sort of potential uprising ideas of the Marylanders, since Washington, D.C. is right there and right next to Virginia, interestingly as well. So here is the song, Maryland, My Maryland. After I play that for you, I will talk a little bit more about it, and then we'll move on to my next topic.
Shore, Maryland, my Maryland, his torches at thy temple door, Maryland, my Maryland, avenge the patriotic war that flecked the streets of Baltimore, and be the battle queen of yore, Maryland, my Maryland. Exiled sons appeal, Maryland, my Maryland, my mother's stay to thee I kneel, Maryland, my Maryland, for life and death, for woe and weal, thy peerless chivalry reveal, and gird thy beauteous limbs with steel, Maryland, my Maryland. thou wilt not cower in the dust. Maryland, my Maryland, thy beaming sword shall never rust. Maryland, my Maryland, remember Carroll's sacred trust. Remember Howard's warlike thrust, and all thy slumbers with the just. Maryland, my Maryland, come, 'tis the red dawn of the day. Maryland, my Maryland, come with thy panoplied array. Maryland, my Maryland, with Ringgold's spirit for the prey, with Watson's blood at Monterey, with fearless Low and dashing May. Maryland, my Maryland, come, for thy shield is bright and strong. Maryland, my Maryland, come, for thy dalliance does thee wrong. Maryland, my Maryland, come to thine own heroic throng that stalks with liberty along, and ring thy dauntless slogan song. Maryland, my Maryland, dear mother, burst the tyrant's chain. Maryland, my Maryland, Virginia should not call in vain. Maryland, my Maryland, she meets her sisters on the plain. Six emperor tis the proud refrain that baffles minions back on Maine. Maryland, my Maryland, I see the blush upon thy cheek. Maryland, my Maryland, for thou wast ever bravely meek. Maryland, my Maryland, but lo, there surges forth the shriek, from hill to hill, from creek to creek, Potomac calls to Chesapeake. Maryland, my Maryland, thou wilt not yield the vandal toll. Maryland, my Maryland, thou wilt not crook to his control. Maryland, my Maryland, better the fire upon thee roll, better the shot, the blade, the bowl, than crucifixion of the soul. Maryland, my Maryland, I hear the distant thunder hum. Maryland, my Maryland, the old line bugle, fife and drum. Maryland, my Maryland, she is not dead, nor deaf, nor dumb. Huzzah, she burns the northern scum. She be, she burns, she'll come, Maryland, my Maryland.
So I'm not sure how easy it is for all of you to make out all the words of that song. It kind of goes in and out with legibility on what it is that they're singing. But one of the first things you might notice is that it's the same tune as the Christmas song, Christmas Tree, O Christmas Tree. Certainly that's probably how that song got that particular tune, but this particular song precedes Christmas Tree, O Christmas Tree. So you could say that, you know, there's just a lot of time-honored, really old, traditional sort of folk tunes that get tacked on to many different songs, like the American National Anthem is actually, the tune to that was actually taken from an old drinking song. I can't remember the name of it off the top of my head. But anyways, you notice at the beginning of the song there, it says, the despot's heel is on the shore, Maryland, my Maryland. His torch is at thy temple door, Maryland, my Maryland. Avenge the patriot's gore that flicked the streets of Baltimore. And he the battle queen of yore, Maryland, my Maryland. So that's talking about the fighting that took place in Baltimore at that depot, and that there were many people who died as a result of the fight there at that particular train station. And of course, I was at that train station myself, and there is a Civil War history museum there at that particular depot. There's no train tracks going by there anymore, of course, but anyways, that museum is really interesting. It's small, but it is still gives out a really good vibe of understanding about what the Civil War was like for them, being in a border state that was a slave state but remained as part of the Union. The person who was there at that museum was a veteran himself, and he had a lot of family history and things that went back to the time of the Civil War. And it's always nice to talk to some of these people to see what they might have to tell you. Anyways, that's the state anthem of Maryland. Now what I'm going to jump back to the things I was saying about lighthouses and the USS Constellation. So as I said, the USS Constellation, it is docked there in Baltimore. Right across from it, of course, is the Chesapeake, which is the light ship that once was sent out into Chesapeake Bay to pretty much light the way through the bay. It has not been in use for that purpose for quite a while, but the Chesapeake anyway is where one goes to get one of those stamps with your passport. It was nice getting that. The second time I had to go to get a stamp for the 7-foot Knoll Lighthouse, I actually had to run through some torrential rain to get to the USS Taney, because apparently the stamp wasn't at the lighthouse itself, it was on board the Taney. And I got drenched as I was running across Baltimore to get to this particular place. Whenever they say it's a 10-minute walk, they mean a much longer walk than that, unless you really know how to move. Anyways, we go to the Constellation. There are several ghosts on this ship that actually, you know, the ship dates back to 1797. And it was built for the purpose of the defense against the marauding freebooters that were pretty much rampant at that time. After the American Revolution, of course, there was a bit of lawlessness that had to be taken care of on the high seas. And this was one of those ships that was sent out to help deal with that. Whenever a ship, of course, is involved with a lot of violent altercations, there's always possibilities of ghosts being a result of things going on there. A lot of times ghosts, they think, are the reaction to horrendous events happening to people as they die, or where something happens that is so important that the ghost feels like it has to stick around for one reason or another in order to either see something through, because they're just compelled to keep coming back and coming back with their sense of loss. One of the ghosts, of course, that is haunting the ship is named Neil Harvey. So Neil Harvey was a gunman. Well, he manned one of the guns on the ship. And during a fight back with the first captain of the ship, the first captain of the ship's name was Captain Thomas Truxton. And while that captain was captain, apparently Neil Harvey fell asleep on duty, and the ship actually came and interacted with a French freebooter, and of course there was an altercation and that French ship was captured. Well, Captain Truxton was so angry that this gunman had fallen asleep that of course he took him, tried him, found him guilty, and executed him, because you know, that's the way they did things back then on ships. If you fall asleep on duty, especially during a time of conflict, that's treasonous and that's the end of you. And so Neil Harvey, his ghost remains on that ship. A lot of times people have been said to have seen him and mistaken him as an actual crew member on that ship, if you can believe it. I don't know how he's dressed. Usually when you see a ghost, they're always dressed in the time period in which they lived. And since the Constellation, I guess, has been sort of a museum ship for a long time, maybe they just assume that he's there dressed in that time period's clothing. That's the story of Neil Harvey. Interesting enough, Captain Thomas Truxton, his ghost, is said to haunt that ship as well. And he's supposed to be wandering around that ship. You don't see him as often as you do Harvey, but this captain is there. Apparently, he feels compelled to remain where he is to be diligently watching his post, kind of like that History of Magic teach on Harry Potter, where apparently he died. He was teaching one day, he ended up dying that night, but then his ghost came out and continued teaching History of Magic. You might get the impression that maybe this is something like that, or his death, you know, coincided with a time period where America was still being plagued by a lot of problems at sea, and so this captain felt compelled to come out and continue being on that ship. Another ghost is a former crewman who was said to have not been able to handle the rigors of the sailor's life, and he ended up hanging himself. And we see that person's ghost wandering around. We have no idea what that particular person's name is. And then we have the example of Carl Hansen. So Carl Hansen was a former crew member of the ship as well. In the mid-20th century, he was a night watchman. And apparently this spirit is a more happy, uplifting type of person. And then he walks the deck in mortality until 1963, and he was retired back in 1963. Then the other ghost that I think is really interesting here is that of, it was an 11-year-old boy. He was a surgeon's assistant, and apparently this boy was murdered on board that ship by a bunch of thugs for some reason or another. Either he had caught them in the act of committing some crime and so they felt compelled to stab him, or maybe they were trying to rob him. The story isn't completely clear about that, but the Constellation is full of ghost stories like this. And as I've noted, this is possibly one of the more haunted ships out there in the world that is still afloat, of course. And, you know, unlike the Queen Mary, it's a lot smaller, and it's not used as a hotel like the Queen Mary is either. So anyways, that's the nature of the ship called the Constellation. The next thing I want to talk about is a situation back in 1814. So during the War of 1812, the city of Baltimore was a major hub for shipping and manufacturing and a lot of other things. And so the British had decided that they would go and they would attack Baltimore. Now, they did this right after they had burned Washington, D.C. to the ground. While one British force was marching up the road to get to Baltimore, another naval contingent was sailing up through Chesapeake Bay, going in towards where Baltimore is. And between them and Baltimore was Fort McHenry. So Fort McHenry, the Battle of Fort McHenry, is what inspired the writing of the Star Spangled Banner by Francis Scott Key. Apparently, he was so overtaken by what he saw when he was on board that British ship that he wrote it down. He was actually on a British ship overlooking the attack on Fort McHenry. And of course, there was a very large bombardment going on there, and there were several people who died during this battle at Fort McHenry. But as our national anthem indicates, our flag was still there and it remained standing. The British were not able to take Fort McHenry, and they were not able to get through our defenses. But one of the things about Fort McHenry is, because of the battles and things that had taken place there, of course, there were a lot of deaths. And one of the people who died in the Battle of Fort McHenry was a man who went by the name William Williams. He was the only black soldier who was standing there in defense at Fort McHenry. He was a runaway slave, and his real name isn't William Williams. That's the name he went by when he was there at the fort. But he stood there and he fought to defend this city against the attacking British, which is really impressive considering the status that he held there. And apparently one of the cannonballs had gotten in and destroyed certain place, and he happened to be there and he died. And so his ghost remains there at Fort McHenry. And when I visited Fort McHenry, of course, I went around and I saw all these things, and I saw these places. They pointed out where different things occurred during the battle. As usual, I was not there at nighttime, and so I wasn't there when the majority of ghost appearances occur. Even though you don't actually see the ghosts there in the daytime, or you don't encounter them It is really a solemn place if you really appreciate what it is that happened there. And William Williams, or Frederick Hall, that was his name before he changed it to William Williams to hide the fact that he was a runaway slave. Those ghosts, some of them, like he, remained there as sentries to watch there over Fort McHenry for if the British should come back and attack once again, as they say. And at that fort, of course, they have a lot of history documentaries about what happened there, which is understandable. It's just amazing when you sit and contemplate the things that happened at these events. Of course, there are several stories about heroism of the people who fought there at Fort McHenry, and anyone who ever goes to Baltimore, that is a must that you have to go see. Now that we've talked about Fort McHenry and about the lighthouses there at the Baltimore Harbor and other areas and aspects around Baltimore, I think it's a good time to maybe steer us away from Baltimore because, as everybody knows, there is more to the state of Maryland than just the city of Baltimore, even though that has a really big historical significance. There's actually another thing that I'd like to discuss, another place. This involves a lighthouse as well, like some of my other stories do, and it involves ghosts. But this situation here is a little bit different because I believe that there's a lot of more historical significance to be had here by where this lighthouse is. This lighthouse is called Point Lookout Lighthouse. It is at the southern tip of St. Mary's County in Maryland, where the Potomac River meets the Chesapeake Bay, and then it's billed as America's most haunted lighthouse. It was built in 1830 by the famed lighthouse builder John Donahue, and Point Lookout was a fashionable resort area with more than 100 cottages where the wealthy spent their leisure time, and then all of that changed, of course, when the Civil War broke out. And if you haven't caught on yet, I'm actually reading something here on a website entitled The Coast Guard Compass, and this aspect of it is dealing with lighthouses and some supernatural stuff. So after the Battle of Gettysburg and the Civil War, the Confederate prisoner of war camp was built just north of that lighthouse. And Camp Hoffman, though the name was rarely used, was in operation from August 1863 until June of 1865, and it was the largest Union prison camp for the Confederate soldiers. In the 2 years it was in existence, approximately 52,000 prisoners of war were incarcerated there. Some 4,000 men died in that camp and then were buried on the site. Then graves were later removed and the bodies moved to other places. Their prospective family homes and things basically is where they ended up moving them. So Point Lookout Lighthouse was only a few hundred feet from the camp's spoke-shaped hospital and served as a stop on the Underground Railroad, providing refuge for escaped slaves from Virginia making their way north. In 1878, Congress authorized the establishment of the Coast Guard Station, which adjoined the lighthouse. While the station became inactive in 1937, it was not formally abandoned until 1948. So Pamela Edwards, who served as Point Lookout keeper during the Civil War, is believed to have been forced to allow Union officials set up in that area inside of the lighthouse to house female prisoners before they were transferred to a federal prison. So this area supposedly became an integration room where torture was often used by the Union Army. Edwards later regretted her decision after seeing the torture and deaths of these prisoners and is believed to have become a rebel sympathizer helping prisoners escape. Sadly, she was removed from her post in 1869. Point Lookout's first four keepers died while they were in service. The first keeper, James Davis, died in the lighthouse after only 3 months of service. His daughter, Anne, then operated the lighthouse until his death in 1847. So she was well-liked woman. She often fantasized about leaving the lighthouse to travel, but of course she never did. Richard Edwards became keeper in 1853, but because of a mysterious illness, he died at the lighthouse in July of 1853. His daughter Martha served from 1852 to 1855, and her sister Pamela served from 1855 to 1869. And then, of course, the longest keeper was William Yeatman, who served 37 years from September 1871 to May of 1908. He is buried only 8 miles north of that lighthouse. The ghost of a woman that is said to be Ann Davis, or is Pamela Edwards, has been seen standing at the top of that stairway wearing a white blouse and long blue skirt with a sad look on her face. Other figures have been seen in the basement. Doors mysteriously open and close, and strange noises, snoring, ghost voices, and footsteps have been heard. Voices have been heard coming out of nowhere. Fire if they got too close to you, and let us not take objection to what they are doing. And of course, with a lot of haunted stories, we always hear about mysterious footsteps and voices, and I think a lot of people might actually hear those things, whether they believe in ghosts or not, and they don't attribute it to ghosts. Whether or not you believe that these voices are ghostly occurrences, that's up to you. There are, of course, other explanations. But I do like to think that a person's presence can often have their imprint left there after they have departed from place, especially if they've lived there a long time, or certain things have happened there that are really powerful events. So for quite some time, an upstairs room smelled every night of decomposition. Attempts to rid the smell were of no use until a parapsychologist identified a feeling of pain and suffering, perhaps from the female prisoners incarcerated there. Then could it be the soul of the Civil War figures have never left Point Lookout? Or perhaps Ann Davis simply could not leave her beloved lighthouse. Maybe Pamela Edwards stayed behind to protect something. Then, of course, you decide. As you can probably guess, there are a lot of lighthouses with these kinds of stories. They claim this is the most haunted of lighthouses, but there are plenty of other stories out there. This one has to deal with Maryland, and of course, a lot of these lighthouses are really isolated. So when people go there, they are probably prone to maybe be hypersensitive to potential strange noises as they come by, or maybe the ghosts and other essences that are not of this world will probably just be more powerfully felt where there are not as many people around to disrupt what the ghosts are doing. And now that I've touched upon battlefields and lighthouses and anthems, I want to go into another direction here. As I said, there's more to Maryland than Baltimore, and of course there's some things that are distinctly Marylandish, or whatever the adjective is in this case. There are quite a few interesting creatures that are said to roam the lands of Maryland, and so that's probably where I'm going to go next. And I don't know how many of you realize this, but there's actually the story of a monster in Chesapeake Bay that they call Chessie. So, like Nessie in Loch Ness and Champ in Lake Champlain, the names, of course, are similar to what the waterway is that that monster inhabits. The Chesapeake Bay monster's name is Chessie for obvious reasons. But having said that, there is actually a supposed monster in Bear Lake that they call Isabella. And this is Bear Lake that's on the border of Idaho and Utah. So since it's Bear Lake, I mean, what are they going to call it? Barry? But anyways, they give it the name Isabella. But most of the time, the monster's got a name attached similar to the name of the waterway that it's in. And Chessie has supposedly been seen by several mariners ever since the 40s. It is supposed to be a huge serpent that makes its way through the waterways. Champ is actually said to be something similar to that. The Loch Ness Monster Nessie, everyone keeps thinking it's like a plesiosaur, you know, an old kind of sea dinosaur type thing, or something similar with, you know, the long neck and the large body. But Chessie is definitely a large serpent that goes around in the waters and has been said to have been the instigator of several disappearances of ships where it wraps its body around a ship and pulls it under, kind of like the giant squid that did the same thing out in the depths of the oceans. It's rarely attributed or blamed for a lot of things, but people who see a lot of strange things out there do a lot of times attribute their sightings to Chessie. And of course, one of the little strange things that has happened is that there was once someone who thought he had a sighting of Chessie, but it ended up actually being some kind of orca or porpoise type creature. And so, having said that, it's like, well, that means that this monster probably needs to go on some kind of diet, because no serpent should be really that big and fat or whatever. But anyways, it's interesting to go and see the kinds of stories that people have to say about Chessie. I'm not going to go into a lot of detail right here now, but because of the way Chesapeake Bay is, of course, I explained how, you know, the British sailed up Chesapeake Bay in order to get to Washington, D.C., and to get to Baltimore, of course. A lot of sightings of this monster, of course, are seen from the areas around Baltimore, and, of course, other sightings, of course, off the coasts of the bay. And the bay is shared by both Virginia and Maryland, so because of its location that, of course, we give it a Marylander affiliation. There is another story. This one I found quite interesting. Apparently, there is a story about a demon truck. This demon truck is said to roam the foothills around Ellicott City, and as it plagues these roadways with the cars that are going through there, apparently midnight is the witching hour, or whatever you want to call it, around which this truck is supposed to appear, and it goes and it terrifies people who are driving around on that particular highway at night. Many accidents have been attributed to this truck. They don't all agree on what exactly this truck looks like, but any kind of large truck going through there, many people might think, oh, is that the demon truck? Of course, you are going to get people who are going to be telling these stories. You might often wonder how many people really believe these kinds of stories, and that's hard to say, but this is a story out of Maryland. You know, like the black dog, not everyone believes in black dog stories, but of course those animals are supposed to be precursors to disaster as well, and many people do strongly believe in them. Then there's also the Maryland goat man, who is out of Beltsville. Now, this goat man, he is apparently the byproduct of a experiment that went wrong, where they were experimenting on some goats and some humans, apparently. Just there's some agricultural research being done at a research center, and this man was unfortunately enough to find himself the recipient of something. I mean, I don't know if it's like Spider-Man and radioactivity or whatever, but they don't really say exactly what it is. And so this goat man is someone who roams around the nights and the areas around Beltville. I don't know if there are any tragedies or disasters attributed to him. I couldn't find anything that talked about it, but a lot of monsters, you know, unexplainable creatures, are always said to roam around different areas, especially when you're outside the main cities. And this particular creature, this goat man, you know, it's similar to other creatures, of course, but this is strictly Maryland. And this goat man, of course, scares a lot of people. He is generally not attributed to be a vicious entity or person, whatever you want to call him. But he does scare a lot of people. He can show up in mysterious places. Your first reaction, of course, to anything that's half man, half goat is going to not be a very pleasant one. I don't think he's supposed to look like a satyr does, the Greek satyr creature. But he's definitely someone that you don't want to come across, because sometimes people say that disasters happen, but that's probably only about 50% of the stories about him that have actually been a precursor to disaster. And so anyone who is in Maryland or wants to visit Maryland, there are all kinds of stories there. Great stories. I have not brought anything of the foodways here from Maryland, basically because I did not have a lot of time, I guess, after the last few segments in order to go into that. And the foodways, of course, of Maryland are unique as well. But these stories, you know, lighthouses, ghosts, creatures, those are the kinds of folklore that everyone is thinking about. The folk song or the state anthem, Maryland, My Maryland, you could say that it's not really a folk song because it's top down. It was created by government people for government people, but I think it is still very culturally significant, especially when you delve into the history of things really well. That is what I have to say about Maryland, and I'm thanking all of you for listening to my episode of Balladish-ish Folklore Now, and I'd like to bid you adieu and remind you that anytime, if any of you have anything you want to say or you have any questions, anything you want me to talk about, my email address is folklorenow33@gmail.com. And just let me know of anything that you'd like to have investigated, and I'll have a look at it. And I will go into more depth than I generally do here with a lot of these state podcasts, because the state podcasts, I'm trying to get a large number of things out instead of delving really deeply into any one thing. So I am probably going to continue on with the state theme for a little bit, because there are a couple other states that I think are significant that should be talked about and we don't always hear about in our history books. Thank you so much for listening to this podcast, and have a wonderful day, and see you next time.